chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I am thrilled to have Patrick Lencioni on the show today. Patrick is an author, speaker, and the founder and president of The Table Group. Well, Patrick Lencioni, I am so delighted. You cannot even imagine how excited I have been to have you on the Something Extra podcast today.
I'm excited myself to read about what you're doing and to know everything that's going on with you. This is a thrill for me, so I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I know in talking to you in a sidebar conversation, you've been a little under the weather and you said, nope, I am going in for that podcast. So I so appreciate it. And I want to give a special shout out, Pat, to our mutual friend, Sean Lambert, because yeah. He's the one that reconnected us and you. We've been in YPO since, I want to say, maybe mid-2000s. And you've spoken at several of the Christian Fellowship Network events that I've been a part of. And so, and we've also, I told you, we've used your material at Technology yep. Partners. So
and we built a few homes down in Tijuana with Sean and Homes for Hope too. It's a wonderful organization. So
love that. Yeah. We've been, our family's been on two of the Homes of Hope.
Us too.
Excursion, yes. And our kids, oh my goodness. I remember our son, because we went at the end of the year and I remember him saying, I can't imagine a better way to start the new year than wow. doing this. And yeah, it's very impactful. So if anybody's interested in that, we'll put that in our show notes, Homes of Hope with Sean Lambert. And I know that they would be delighted to have some volunteers. The more volunteers they have, right, Pat, the more homes that they can build.
So. That's right. It's quite an experience.
It's important. Well, I want to ask you something, and I did not plan on doing this, but before we started recording, you said something to me about you'd read about the meaning and the precipice behind the Something Extra podcast, and you said something to me that was so profound and so beautiful, and I asked you, would you just tell our listeners a little bit about what you said to me?
Yeah, we're talking about Down syndrome and people that have that. And it seems to me that their sense of gratitude and joy is like a foretaste of heaven. And I meet so many people in the world who've lost sight of what's important and have lost their joy. And I know it's easy for us to do that. And then we can see this person with Down syndrome and realize they see the goodness in the world. And I really have always believed, like, I think these are the angels that God gives us to help us understand what he's got in store for us. And I mean that. And in the Bible, when it talks about, we have to have the faith of a child, and we get older and we get cynical. And I think that I honestly do think that these angels with Down syndrome are there to show us the way. And I mean that. And sincerely, I look at them and I think, man, if I could have that joy, you know, that's what God intends for us. So God bless them.
So beautiful. I love it. And of course, I couldn't agree more. And we have one of those angels that live in our house.
Yeah.
And we see it every day with her. And I told you, it can just be the most ordinary, really no frill, no fluff day. And she'll say, this is a good day.
Yeah.
I'm like, what a great mindset to have.
I mean, so truly, truly. And how many people I know who are wealthy and powerful and influential, and they feel like, what's missing in my life? And it's that faith of a child, the simplicity of what God gives us. So they teach us so much.
Well, thank you so much for that. You really blessed my heart this morning with what you said. And so I appreciate you repeating it to our listeners. But I am so excited, Pat, to dig into this treasure trove of your wealth and your wisdom and knowledge. You've written so many books. We're going to talk about a few of those. But before we get into all that, can you take me back to your childhood? I would love for you to expand on this. I read in one of your books, I can't remember which one it was, but you dedicated the book to your mom and dad. And here's what you said. Your dad taught you the value of hard work, and your mom encouraged you to write.
Yeah, yeah. My dad was a very hardworking man, and that was very clear. Work mattered. And so I learned that from him, and that I was always interested in writing. But I came from a pretty poor family. Writing wasn't a career that you would pursue. But I do remember my mom thinking that was kind of cool that I liked to write things. And so from a very young age, I just kept writing all the time. And, you know, they say like to get good at something, you have to do it for 10,000 hours. And I never realized that's what I was doing, but I was just always writing when I was a kid. And so by the time I get to be an adult and through school and other things, I think I finally got to the place where maybe I got to 5,000. So I got to be a decent writer, still working on being an excellent writer. But so I appreciated that what I got from them.
So did you write stories, and did you tell your mom stories? And I mean, were you doing this even before you could actually write?
You know, I think that I don't think it was all that overt. I just think that I remember as a kid always writing things. And I remember like having a job in high school and working at a restaurant and standing at the front desk where I was working and writing stories when there was no customers there. And I was just constantly interested in writing and fiction and things like that. But it was never very formal, but it was just something I did kind of on the side. And so when I first got encouraged to write a book, I took a screenwriting class in college. And I remember when I first got encouraged to write a book, when I was in my third job, I remember thinking, I'm not going to write a regular business book. I'm going to write a work of fiction that people will want to read. And that's kind of become my thing. All my books but one are fiction stories. So I get and I write very much like a screenplay. It's very dialogue heavy. It's not a lot of description. It's more about like what's going on in the dialogue and the character development. So,
yeah, that's so beautiful. Well, you know, and you've probably done studies on this. I have not, but I've often heard people say that what you do as a little boy or a little girl, it goes for full circle. And sometimes that's what you do as an adult. So if you are a little boy that builds with Legos all the time, then you might end up being an architect or something like that. And I think that'd be a really interesting study to do.
You know, we just about 3.5 years ago, we launched a new product called the Six Types of Working Genius, which was an accident by the grace of God. We discovered around understanding what kind of work people love to do. And the thing about it is you can trace it back to when you were a kid. When we figure out there's these six different kinds of work, and two of them are what we call your working genius, where you get joy and energy. And the thing is, people always say, does it change over time? And we trace it all the way back. Like the things I love to do, I loved doing as a child. And so one of the things is we like to help parents. We just came out with a student assessment, because the earlier you can help your kids understand what their geniuses are, the more you can encourage them to pursue those, because I think God put us on this earth for a reason, and he gave us gifts, and we're supposed to unwrap those gifts and use them. And sometimes people go through life and they never get to know what those gifts are. So,
amen. I love that you're doing that, because I've always said that, even when I talk to younger people, when I was going through school, there were no assessments. There was not Strength Finders. There was not DISC. There was not Myers-Briggs. There was none of that when I was going through school. But I said, if you have the opportunity to do assessments, do it, because the more you understand yourself, I think the more, to your point, that you can get on the path that you were, that was purposed for you from before the time you were born. So I just love that.
Mm-hmm. And I love all those assessments, and I've done them all. We've used them in my work. This new one that we call the 6 Types of Working Genius is the one that's most clearly applicable to the tasks you do every day. So like the Myers-Briggs, I love it, and StrengthsFinder, all these different things. But we had never really found one that could just say, this is why you go about your job this way. And whether mm-hmm. whether you're a mom and you're working at home, or whether you're a CEO, or whether you're a student, or whether you're retiring and trying to figure out what the next thing is, it kind of comes down to which tasks do you like to do every day. And so that's, we discovered this because I was getting kind of grumpy at work one day, and somebody said, why do you get grumpy? And I said, I don't know, let's figure this out. And that's how this came about.
That's so funny. Well, you know, how many times is something developed because you see a gap or you see something like that, a challenge that you're going through, right? Yeah. I totally love that. Well, I know that you grew up in Bakersfield, California. You've already talked about your mom and dad, and I know that you grew up with a really strong sense of faith and family, Pat. Yeah. And you say that really, those factors are two of the biggest factors that you believe have contributed to your success.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and faith is one of those things you get, hopefully you can get it when you're young, but then you have to develop it on your own. Like they say, God has no grandchildren, you know, it's just his children and you have to become his child. And so I've been very blessed that I got that foundation from my parents. And then throughout my life, I've been able to stay close to God, wandering, as we all do. And so that is the foundation of my life. I mean, to say anything else would be silly. I've learned that nothing matters. Without him, I'm done. And so I'm convinced of that. And as far as family goes, you know, early in my career, before I had children, my wife and I, when we got married, somebody said to me one day, hey, Pat, when you have children, an executive said, I have a 16-year-old child and I don't know him. So he said, don't do that. And I remember early on in my career, I had a lot of opportunities to travel and do things. And I would say no, because I wanted to be part of my family. And so I was very blessed not to lose sight of that in my career. And so, faith and family, without those, I mean, anything else I do doesn't seem to have any meaning. So,
I could not agree with you more. So I really love that. Well, you started your career at Bain & Company, which is a very prestigious top management consulting firm for listeners that may not know. Then you went on to work for the prestigious tech companies Oracle and Sybase, which were in technology. So I totally know those companies. But tell me this, what do you believe is some of the early leadership lessons that you learned from working with these organizations?
Well, I learned a lot of what I thought was problematic. And that's not to criticize those companies, but when I started my career, there was no interest in the human side of business. Everything was what we call smart, which was like just analysis. And I went into these companies and I was like, but people don't get along here. They don't understand one another. They're not listening to one another. And I remember when I was at Bain, I went to a client event and we presented a bunch of data to them, and it was clear that they were involved in political battles with other parts of their organization. And I said, we need to help them with that. And somebody said, they don't pay us to do that. And I was like, one day I want to get paid for helping people with that, because if people aren't working well together, we're wasting time and energy by rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. So that's where I got my interest in what I do today. It wasn't really much of a field back then. And mm-hmm. And I kept trying to go back to grad school and realizing, well, there's not really grad schools that are teaching this very well. And so I just kind of kept developing my own thing. And now today, this whole field that we call organizational health is quite prominent. And thank God for that, because I think so much human misery takes place in organizations that are technically smart, but interpersonally poor. Mm-hmm. And so my thing is, I love strategy and technology and finance and marketing and all that stuff. But if human beings aren't dealing with each other in a functional way, all that stuff doesn't quite matter as much. Mm-hmm. And I know from the work you guys do at Technology Partners, it's the same thing. You get that.
Yes, absolutely we do. In fact, we have a leadership development program for technologists, Pat, and we say it's the human side of technology.
Oh,
That's all we're teaching. We're not teaching the technical skills. We're teaching how do you lead a team? How do you communicate up and down and across? How do you lead change in an organization? All of those type skills.
And Lisa, I have to tell you, and I've been doing my work here at my company for about 27 years, and I have yet to go into a company and think, well, these people are just too dumb. Everybody's smart enough to be successful. What they usually lack is the ability to work together. And so we think that the secret to the competitive advantage is getting people to work as a team and to make their organization healthy and functional, because everybody's pretty smart these days, but what they aren't necessarily is healthy. So that's what we do.
Right. Yeah. And I know that that's what you talk about, is that is the competitive advantage of getting your, and you've got a book called The Advantage. We'll talk a little bit about that, but kind of backing up for a minute, you, the precipice for you getting to into this work, you founded the Table Group in 1997. You've spent almost 30 years now. As you said, 27 years, Pat, you know, working with Fortune 500 companies, sports teams, nonprofits, all of those. Tell me, what has been, with the work that you've done, what has been the most surprising to you?
You know, I think what surprises me is there's a great quote a friend of mine told me years ago by Samuel Johnson that said, people need to be reminded more than they need to be instructed. And I'm surprised at how bright people are, but how much we forget. And, you know, I think about this in my faith life too. It's like, we forget the simple and most important things. And when, so I go work with a CEO of a company and they're very bright people and they're well-educated. And then you tell them simple things and like, oh, I forgot. And so we, most of us need to be reminded constantly of the things that matter most. And yet, there's this false sense that we're pursuing new knowledge all the time. And it's like, you know, we forget so much. I'm amazed that I'll go back and read a book or watch a movie that I haven't seen in a few years and how much of it I forget. Hey, Lisa, I'll go back. I don't do it very often, but I should do it more. I'll go back and read one of my books and I don't know what's going to happen next. And I'm like, ooh, this is interesting. It's like, I wrote this and I don't remember. So I think what amazes me is how much knowledge and wisdom we forget. And how much we need to be constantly reminded.
Could not agree more. And the thing is, Pat, I feel like it's an accelerated rate that we're putting information in.
Oh, and we're retaining less and less of it.
I know.
I'm convinced that with all the technology and all the, everything else, we are not wiser and smarter than we were 50 years ago. I'm convinced of that. And I think about how, you know, I've been under the weather for the last 9 days. Well, that means I've been sitting in front of a television because I'm too brain dead to read, and it's not making me smarter. I feel so weird after just sitting there. And I think in the old days, there was a lot more contemplation. There was a lot more, you know, pondering of wisdom and things like that. And today I think there's a lot more coming at us that we're not really sinking. It's not sinking in. So we need to be reminded constantly.
We do need to be reminded. And maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe there needs to be the information coming in, and then maybe exercise of more discourse where we're talking about it, right? And then that helps us get in it into our DNA. I don't know. We'll solve that in another podcast, Pat.
There you
maybe.
Go.
But tell me what I can surmise what this is or presume what this is, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What's brought you the most joy?
Well, we go back to faith and family. And joy is such an interesting word, and boy, I've learned so much about childhood wounds and our ability to actually experience joy. But it's usually when I spend more time with God and paring down everything that I'm thinking about and really focusing on the simple things. And you know, so my wife and I have been married 30. Gosh, it's going to be 32 years coming up, and so many difficulties. And the joy of working through those and growing closer over that time. And the family, you know, family is wonderful. And there's challenges and working through those things. So I think that peace and joy are very elusive, and that's what we're really hungering for. Happiness is pretty fleeting. But peace and joy, I think it comes from faith and family for me. And the friends of the people I've worked at. I have there's people that I've worked with here for, I've worked with almost 30 years, and the depth of relationship I have with them, those are the greatest sources of joy for me.
Yeah.
Certainly not vacation or thrills or money or any of those kinds of things.
If it is a vacation and we have one coming up, it's just that time with the family.
Exactly.
It's that concentrated time with the family. So I could not agree with you more. So you did talk about some of the challenges. There have been challenges. It's not all unicorns and rainbows, but you've been on this kind of entrepreneurial journey. You know, what are some of the challenges, you know, that you faced and how did you overcome those? And I can presume that too. I'm sure it goes back to your faith and how you have overcome those.
Yeah. You know, I think so much of it just has to do with maturing and growing up and realizing that the things you thought were going to make you happy that don't, you know, I think that's the crazy thing in life, I think, Lisa, is that we think we're going to be happy by achieving something. And if we ever achieve it fully, then we realize, okay, that didn't do it. But if you never quite get there, you think, well, one day I'll get there, and you keep climbing the ladder. And I love this story about there was this football coach named Mike Singletary. He was the coach of the San Francisco 49ers, but he played for the Chicago Bears, and he'd wear a cross on the outside of his shirt. And they'd say, why do you wear that cross? Have you always done that? He goes, oh, no. I started wearing this after my team won the Super Bowl. And he goes, they said, why? And he goes, because I realized I wasn't happy. It didn't work. And I had been climbing a ladder that was on the wrong wall, and I needed to climb down and climb the right wall. And so the thing about it is the best thing that can happen if you achieve your dreams is realizing that probably wasn't the right thing to pursue. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, I've learned that all the achievements I thought I wanted to get, like writing a book or working with these kind of companies or getting well known, none of those satisfy. And the only thing that satisfies is knowing God and loving your family and then loving the people God puts in your life, whoever they are. Yes. And yet I need to be reminded of that, Lisa, every darn day, because it's so easy to get caught up in worldliness and pursuing those silly things that don't work.
Yes. Oh my goodness. You are so resonating with my heart. In 2022, my word, which was two words, and I have a friend that said, it's okay, just put a hyphen in there, Lisa, love more. Because I said, okay, if those are the two greatest commandments, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself, I better figure out how to get better at that. Yeah. And really, I mean, it's profound and it's, you know, sometimes not easy to do. Sometimes people, you know, myself included, sometimes we're not easy to love, right?
Oh my gosh. Easy. Absolutely. And, you know, and I don't know if you're familiar with C.S. Lewis and the Screwtape Letters, one of his books, but, and the devil is just always there just trying to distract us. Just like watch another TV show, pursue another financial goal, stay curious about something that doesn't really matter. And that's enough to keep us from having peace. So
yes.
Yeah, it's a daily battle. It's a daily battle.
Yes, very much so. Let me ask you this. You know, when you started Table Group, it was a calling. You stepped out with courage. You had a lot of courage to step out because you felt like truly that was your calling to help these organizations become more healthy. What about if there is a listener out there and they're feeling some sort of nudge, what to kind of do something similar, not the Table Group, but maybe they're being nudged in a certain way to kind of step out with some courage. What do you have some advice for them? One piece of advice?
You know, again, the only thing of wisdom I can say is pray. Because when you say, okay, God, I love this. A friend of ours, the kids are always told, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do when you grow up? And she says, the question should be, what do you think God wants you to do? And so ask yourself, God, are you calling me to do this? Because if you're calling me to do this, then I can do it without fear. But if you're not calling me to do this and I want to do it, then I might probably have a good reason for fear. Mm-hmm. And so I would say just pray about it and then have peace. And if your goal is to do what you're meant to do, it's a lot less scary than if your goal is to get rich. Because when we started our company, we just wanted to enjoy the work, enjoy one another, and do something meaningful. And we enjoyed every step of the way, Lisa. It was never about, well, one day we hope to get here. And so people will call us and say, hey, Pat, we're starting our own company. How can we be like your company? And we're like, we don't know. Just love every step. And if the first step is the only step, you know, we were like, hey, I didn't have any books when we started our company. We thought we were just going to be this little consulting firm that drove around near where we lived and helped companies. And we were like, that would be enough. If we could pay our mortgage and like working with one another, that would be enough. And so God just kept blessing us with other things. But it was never like it has to get better if we're going to be happy. So
that is such sage advice. Love every step. Mm-hmm. Love every step. Well, Pat, I want to get into a little bit of your books, and then we do need to take a quick break. But we're gonna just scratch the surface with Pat Lencioni today, folks. And so I'm really hoping that you will reach out to the Table Group and get some of it. They have amazing resources. But I know now, I think you've spoken well over 300,000 business people, 40 countries, worked with hundreds of organizations. You've written at least 13 must-read books, maybe more by now. I wish we could do a deep dive, but we're not going to be able to do that. I'm just going to read a few of these. The Six Types of Working Genius is your newest book, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. The Motive, The Advantage, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which is really a New York Times bestseller multiple times. I bet it's on a lot of leaders' bookshelves right now. The Ideal Team Player. I told you my good friend Kristen Bonham loves that book. She said that's her favorite leadership book. The Truth About Employee Engagement, Death by Meeting, Overcoming Five Dysfunctions, The Four Obsessions of an Extraordinary. It goes on and on and on. It's really remarkable, again, what you've done here. But I want to just dig in because I do believe this is a classic. The Six Types of Working Genius, I'm sure, will become a classic too. I cannot wait to do a deep dive into that one. But The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, it was written in 2002. It still remains a fixture on the national bestseller list. It's really, in kind of going back to what you said, it's really a leadership fable. It's kind of written more like in fiction form. But, you know, I wanted to just kind of touch on the high points, if we can. And obviously, like I said, we're not going to be able to do a deep dive. But you've already said this, but I'd love for you to say it again. So let me start out by asking you this question. Is it the latest and greatest technology and an ironclad strategy that helps organizations win, Pat?
No, of course that's permission to play. You got to be smart enough. But the real differentiator is, can you get people working together? And we see this in the world of sports all the time. And sports is a great analogy because there's a score and you can see the most talented teams don't necessarily win. It's the ones who know how to work together. And this is true in every endeavor in the world. And yet, it's so tempting to want to just go with the measurables. And mm-hmm. and yet, we if we really look at it, it's the getting a group of people that know how to work together, complement one another, set their egos aside. Those are the ones that actually accomplish the most. And there's nothing soft about that. It's not as easy to measure, but it's not soft. It's not touchy-feely. And so that to me is the greatest competitive advantage.
Right. Yeah. So we really should pay attention to it. One of my favorite quotes, I'm a big quote junkie. I've been a quote junkie since middle school. and you've got lots of isms. My really dear friend and colleague, Dan Roberts, always says, everybody has isms. Pat Lencioni has a lot of isms, and I'm going to talk about some of those a little bit later. But one of my favorite quotes, Pat, is if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. That's a great quote.
Yes. And it's really true, right? I mean, if you really want to go far, go together as a team. So,
wow. That's a great quote.
Yeah. You can write that one down. I did not coin that. I'm not really sure who did, but you can definitely use that. Let me ask you this. You say building a strong team is both possible and remarkably simple, but it is also painfully difficult.
Yes.
I'd love for you to unpack that because that's really, truly kind of paradoxical.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think in life, people are looking for really complex solutions that are going to make it easy. And the most important things in life, whether it's raising a family, having a good marriage or building a business, it's not as complicated as we think. It's just hard. And And we have to embrace the hardness of it. You know, it's doing hard things every day, simple but hard things every day. But so many people are like, well, how can I have a great marriage? Isn't there some like book I can read that's going to give me some trick of the trade? It's like, no, no, no. It's like raising kids. It's like, just love them every day. Apologize when you need to. Discipline them. Spend time with them. And like, yeah, but there's got to be more to it than that. It's like, actually, there's not. It just do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true in running a business too. It's like it's like a marriage or a family. It's like every day you got to do your due diligence. And so many leaders, and I write about this in The Motive, kind of lose sight of why they're a leader. And they're like, well, maybe this is just supposed to be fun, or maybe it's just supposed to be a way for me to get to be cool, or maybe to make a lot of money. And it's like, nah, if your motive for being a leader is not to serve others, then you're not going to want to do the hard things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if your motive in life, a good friend of mine, Daniel Harkavy, is a writer and a good friend. He said to me one day, Pat, did you ever think that the purpose of marriage is not to make you happy, but to make you holy?
Holy. Yes.
And it's like, oh, that changes everything. But if you go into it thinking it's to make me happy, and if you go into leadership to be like, well, this is supposed to be easy and fun, then you're not going to do the hard thing. So, so I don't know how I drifted to that, but it is simple. But it's hard.
Right. And so, yeah, there's another book out there and I can't quote the author, but Do Hard Things.
Yes.
And I love what you said, do hard things every day, do it consistently. And that is probably the difference, right? Yeah. It's that consistent, disciplined approach to building your business, to building a family, whatever the case may be. Well, we've got so much more to talk about, Pat, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be back on the Something Extra podcast with Pat Lencioni.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch-up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend, Pat Lencioni. So, Pat, we were just talking about the five dysfunctions of a team. And on 189, and you don't have to do a deep dive into these, but you have a pyramid.
Yeah.
And at the bottom of the pyramid, the first dysfunction that you see is absence of trust.
Yes. Yes. You know, this is at the core of everything when we work with an organization. It's like, trust is the foundation for everything else. And that sounds obvious, you know, Lisa, but when we talk about trust on a team, we're talking about what we call vulnerability-based trust, which is not the kind of trust that just says, well, you and I, we've known each other for years, so we can trust each other and predict each other's behavior. Vulnerability-based trust is when human beings are willing and able to be completely, as we say, kind of naked with each other around what they're good at, what they're not good at, when they make a mistake, when they need help, when they have to apologize. When you can be completely open and human, vulnerable, that's where trust gets built on a team. And this is not something that's easy for most people to do. You know, we come out of the womb kind of protecting ourselves. And so trying to get people on a team to trust one another is the first and most important step. Because if you can do that, if you can get people to be vulnerable and say, hey, I know I made a mistake there, or I know you're smarter than I am about this, or, you know, I was rude to you yesterday, I'm sorry, or, you know, I need help, I know I need help. When people can do that, it changes everything. And it enables us to overcome the other four dysfunctions of a team. But if we can't build trust, the ceiling on what our teams can accomplish and our organizations can accomplish is so low. It's so low. So trust is the foundation of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first thing we do with every executive team we work with.
So I'm sure you've got, there's workshops, there's resources. I mean, the table group have so many good things. So if this is resonating with you, listeners, I would just really encourage you to reach out, because we're not going to be able to cover everything. The second one is fear of conflict. So
right.
Conflict avoidance is a big thing. And I'm kind of a peacemaker. I don't like conflict. So, but fear of that conflict, there's healthy ways to deal with conflict, isn't there?
Yeah. And if there's no trust, though, conflict is a bad thing. See, that's why we start with trust. Because if you don't trust another person, engaging in conflict with them is actually a bad idea, because people aren't going to admit when they're wrong. They're going to try to win. But if there is vulnerability-based trust, then people who argue with one another, they're just looking for the best possible answer. So if you and your husband are arguing about the right thing to do for your kids, it may be hard, but if you trust each other, you know you just care about your kids. And if you convince him or he convinces you, you'll go, oh gosh, I'm so glad you convinced me. But if there is no trust, conflict is without purpose. So that's why it always starts with trust. But now conflict itself is a really good thing. And yet we live in a society that more and more thinks that there's a problem if you're disagreeing. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, and this is biblical. This is true in all relationships. It's true in every marriage, in every friendship. Working through disagreement is the path to a deeper relationship. And yet we have this false notion that we're supposed to always be nice. And I think if we understood the difference between kindness and niceness, it would go a long way. Because being nice to somebody when you disagree with them, there's nothing kind about that.
And it's not authentic.
Exactly.
Not authentic.
In fact, right. And it leads them later to feel betrayed when they realize, oh, you weren't actually being honest with me. And, you know, I see this happening in churches all the time, and it's so sad, because in churches, authenticity is so important, but they have this false idea that you can never disagree. And it's the reason why in the parking lot at so many churches, people are saying difficult things about one another, because they don't feel comfortable saying it directly to one another. And and again, that's just a misapplication of kindness. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. That doesn't mean be nice to our neighbor as ourselves. Jesus was not always nice. He was always loving.
Yes. Loving and just. The third one is lack of commitment. And then you've got avoidance of accountability and inattention to results. And that's at the top of the pyramid. So, yeah. I mean, sometimes we can put the results at the bottom of the pyramid, right? And we have it all backwards.
Yeah. You know, all of this goes to the fruits of our labor. Like, are we going to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish? That's how we know if something, a team is about the results. That doesn't mean you always get the results you want, but over time, good teams tend to win. And to do that, though, I want to go to the fourth one, which is the holding each other accountable, because this is the hardest one of all. And that is, in order to accomplish the results you need to accomplish, people have to hold one another accountable. And this is the lowest score on the assessment that people take. People just don't like to turn to somebody and say, hey, you know something? I think you need to do better. I think you could do more. I think we need more from you. And it is so antithetical to people on a team. And yet, when people love each other, this one is based completely in love, you will say to somebody, I know that you can do better than you're doing now. And yet, it's so often on teams that people will balk at that moment. They'll see somebody not performing and they'll think, well, I care about them, so I don't want to say anything to them. And that's actually a violation of love. It's like being a parent. If you know that your child is doing something that's not good for them and not good for the family, and you don't say anything to them, you would say, that's not love. And yet we do it at work all the time. Mm-hmm. And so accountability is probably the single thing that is lacking on most teams, is people not being willing to push each other to get better because they're afraid that it's going to make them unpopular. And then that's going to hurt them.
You don't want to go there. You don't want to hurt their feelings. You don't want to come across. But yeah, I mean, to your point, do you want them to settle for less? Do you want them? And it's really better for that person, right? If they reach their full potential.
Well, exactly. And the other thing is, imagine when somebody gets fired from a job and then they're saying, well, why didn't anybody tell me I needed to get better? And this happens all the time. It's like, well, I just didn't want to because I didn't want you not to like me. It's like, oh, so that was more important than you actually telling me what I needed to do to improve. And this happens all the time. So many managers, and there's a technical term I like to use because I'm one of these too, is a lot of leaders who don't do this, we're called wusses. We don't like to tell people hard things.
Right.
And yet we end up, people suffer when we don't tell them hard things up front because they can't get better. It happens all the time. It's one of the great tragedies in the workplace is when people aren't told the truth and then they're left to suffer because of it.
But it's something we can improve on, though, right? We can improve on that, though, Pat, right?
And absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you're a wuss like me, you need to go to the people that you work with and say, hey, you guys, just so you know, I'm a wuss. So I might notice something about you and it's going to be really hard for me to tell you. And I want to tell you because I know it's in your best interest. And then people will actually coach each other and say, I need to know. Tell me what I can do better. You know, but we have to get away from the idea that the purpose of work is to protect ourselves. And it's really, and this gets back to that book I wrote called The Motive. And that is, if your job to go in to be a leader is to be popular, then that's probably a good reason not to be a leader. When I go to graduations and people say, go out and be a leader, change the world, I always want to say, no, don't do it unless you're willing to suffer for others. Because if you're not willing to suffer for others, please don't be a leader. We've seen too often in the world when leaders become leaders for reasons other than willingness to suffer for others, how it brings about a lot of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Wow. There's so many things going through my mind right now, but I'm going to keep us moving here. I told you I've been a quote junkie since middle school. I don't know why that is. I just think sometimes they can be just, there's a simple yet profound message in them that's just a good anchor.
Yeah.
But you've got some here. I'm just going to read a few of them and just would love to hear you unpack it just a little bit. We've already kind of talked about this a little bit, but I'm going to say it again. Success is not a matter of mastering subtle, sophisticated theory, but rather embracing common sense with uncommon levels of discipline and persistence.
Yeah, that's one of those things. So, as you know, I'm from Bakersfield, California, which is not necessarily the height of sophistication in the world. Also, I never went to graduate school. I tried a few times. And every time I did, something else would happen in my career, and I loved it. And so, to say that I'm not a sophisticated person, I'm not. And so, when I point things out to people, and I meet with CEOs and some of the most brilliant people, it's usually me pointing out something that's really simple that calls on their discipline. That they're like, oh, and they'll say things like, "That's brilliant," and I don't know who once said that. You know, simplicity is where brilliance lies. You know, and yet we're in a world where people like to think it's like, I want to be the smartest guy or gal in the room. And there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. I remember I heard a great quote recently that said, a long time ago, it said, knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. and the world is so the world is far shorter on wisdom than it is knowledge. And that's why you can go into colleges and universities today. Colleges and universities are great sources of craziness these days. And these are people that are supposedly intelligent, but they lack wisdom. And we can see that they're almost deconstructing society right now because there's such a lack of wisdom. So common sense is so much more important. And that's not something you find in a book. It's something you find, you know, on your knees, I think. So.
Yes. Could not agree more. I love this because I think there's a book out there. I don't know. I probably had the title wrong, but like Death by Meetings or something like that.
That's my book.
Oh, is that your book?
That's my book.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That is so funny. Because you say the majority of meetings should be discussions that lead to decisions. And you said so many times a meeting will just be like information.
Oh, yeah.
Viewed out, and those are not helpful. Put that in an email. Put that in something else. But
yeah,
unpack that for a minute.
Yeah, and you know, remember I told you before I was a screenwriter in a previous life in college, and I kind of came to the conclusion that the problem with meetings was the same problem with bad movies. There's got to be some level of conflict, like stakes are high, and when you go to a meeting and nobody debates, nobody argues, nobody mixes it up, it's so boring. And if you go to a movie where there's nothing at stake, it's so boring. And yet we tend to think that a good meeting is one that begins on time, ends on time, and nobody gets upset. And then we go, why do I hate meetings? It's like, because nobody's interested in that. You got to go to meetings, mix it up, have conversations, and that informs good decisions. And it's fun, but it's exhausting too.
Right. I could not agree more. I love this one. Clients don't expect perfection from the service providers they hire, but they do expect honesty and transparency.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Getting Naked, which is the least related to organizational health. It's really about customer service, and it's about how we serve customers too. And we've found that when you go to a client and you make a mistake, if you celebrate it and you say, and you call it out, they will, that is actually a way to get stronger loyalty with your clients. But if you cover it up or pretend like you didn't, they see it, they know it, and they're like, oh, so your pride is going to prevent you from acknowledging when you do something wrong. People are shocked at the number of bad questions and bad suggestions I've made to clients over the years. Because I realize that if you, when I say, I don't make a suggestion, say you should do this, in a meeting, I'll say, hey, have you guys ever thought of this? And sometimes I'll go, oh, that wouldn't make any sense at all. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. I'm an idiot. And they're like, no, you're not an idiot, but that was a dumb. And it's only by them seeing you being genuine about the things you say and do that they trust you. Because I've also worked in companies that said, never make a mistake. Never admit when you make a mistake. Go in there and be smarter than your clients. They don't trust you because they realize you're just kind of trying to manipulate them. So our approach to working with clients is to go and be naked, be human, and be the first to acknowledge, oh, that was a bad idea. Or, oh, I made a mistake there. And when you do that, they realize, okay, you're totally authentic. We want your authenticity because we can trust you. And then they benefit from the good ideas that you have.
Yeah, I cannot agree more with that, because I always say when we make a mistake, we're going to make mistakes. We're human. We're not perfect, right? So we are going to make mistakes, but just admit it and say, oh, we're sorry. We led you down the wrong path there. Let us make it right.
Right.
Just like Chick-fil-A. Their customer service is so amazing. I can only remember one time, Pat, not having my order exactly right, and they gave me a card for a free chicken sandwich. I'm like, oh, okay, it's fine. No problem.
You know, I do some work with this company called Dutch Bros. And they're a coffee company now. They have like 1,000 coffee shops around. They're a drive through, and they let their broistas, as they call it, give people free stuff when they're having a bad day. If somebody comes in and goes, I'm having a bad day today, and they're like, here, just take this for free. That's fine. And it's like, it's so human. And if they do something wrong, they're like, here you go. It's all right. It's on me. And people are like, that actually achieves loyalty more than if you were perfect.
Yeah. Oh, could not agree more. That's beautiful. I'll just read one more here, and then I want to get into some other stuff. But you say here, because we're going back to accountability. And again, you said it's the hardest thing, or the thing that you see lacking in organizations the most, because it's hard. It is hard to hold people accountable. It's hard to say that. But you said the best kind of accountability on a team is peer-to-peer.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's not the job of the leader is to create an environment where people hold each other accountable. But the only way that happens is if the leader makes it clear that they will hold people accountable. But 90% of the time, the people who see a problem first are our peers. And it's kind of like on a sports team. If your two players are on the court and one sees another person not doing their job, should they wait for a timeout to go over to the coach and rat out the person and have the coach tell them no? Or should they just go directly to that person and say, hey, I think you need to play better defense over here. And the person goes, oh, you're right. That was my bad. I'm sorry. That's healthy.
Yes.
That's kind of like siblings going to one another instead of saying, I'm going to tell mom and dad on you. It's like, well, let's just hold each other accountable. And so on the best teams, the leader doesn't have to get involved that often. But if the leader is a wuss like I am, then people are like, why should I do it? The leaders, if the mom is always going to let you off the hook, then after a while, you're going to stop going directly to your sibling.
Right. Yeah. I have a confession. Yeah. I make a confession. I'm kind of a wuss too.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of us.
Yeah. I think on Myers-Briggs, you're ENFP, I think.
Me. Yep.
Yeah. And I am reported, I am ENFJ. J, but estimated I'm ENFP. So I'm kind of was too. And I wonder if that's kind of related to our personality types, possibly.
Yeah, the feeling preference is one where we overvalue the emotional content, which is fine. But it just makes us a little more susceptible to like, let's let him off the hook. I like to say that, you know, I have a bleeding heart and I probably shouldn't be a judge sometimes. Because sometimes to be a judge, you gotta do what's just, and that might not necessarily coincide with my emotions at that moment.
Yeah. That's good. Well, let's talk about this one just real quickly, because for my friend Kristen Bonham,
yep,
that loves the ideal team player, you know, there are three qualities of the ideal team player. Can you unpack those for us?
Yeah. Now talk about a simple thing here.
Yes.
In fact, I wasn't going to write this book, and a friend of mine said, you got to write a book about this because this is really powerful. We discovered that there were three virtues that if a person has them, they're going to be a great team player. And it's so ridiculously simple. And we made these our core values years ago before we realized they were really the definition of a team player. And they are, the first one is you have to be humble. And if a humble just means you're more interested in others than you are in yourself, it's not about you. The second one is hungry. You have to have a strong work ethic. You're not easily satisfied. You want to work hard. Mm-hmm. So humble and hungry. And the third one is smart, but not intellectually smart, but interpersonally smart. Like you kind of have a clue about how your behaviors impact others.
Mm.
And if a person is humble, hungry, and smart, man, put them on your team. They're going to do great.
Yeah.
But if they're lacking one of those in an egregious way, it's going to be a big problem, especially if it's humility. So we didn't realize when we wrote this book that Dave Ramsey, my friend, he uses this to do hiring. They have three conference rooms at their headquarters, humble, hungry, and smart conference rooms. And a lot of organizations really do hiring based on this, because if you find people that have all three of those qualities, they're going to find ways to add value. They're going to slide into the organization well. They're going to be wonderful to work with. So those are the three qualities that make for teamwork. And if you hire for that and develop people for that, then the five dysfunctions of a team becomes very easy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Probably becomes a non-issue at that point. Yeah. Well, I know that the Six Types of Working Genius is your newest book. You already kind of touched on it just a little bit, but can you tell us a little bit more about that book?
Yeah, we are convinced that this model is going to be bigger than the five dysfunctions of a team. Because in 3 years or so, we've had about 1 million people take this assessment. And we discovered it by accident, by the grace of God. We realized this, and here's how it came from. I was getting frustrated at work. I love the people I work with, and I like what I do. I love what I do. And I would come to work, and I'd get grumpy. And somebody once said, hey, why do you get grumpy? And I said, I don't know. Let's figure it out. And what we realized was, in the course of any kind of work, there's six different activities that are necessary. Six activities. And only two of those are what any of us have as a genius. That's where we get joy and energy. God made us to get joy and energy out of doing two of those six. It would be like pouring coffee into a Yeti mug and putting the lid on it. If you're doing your geniuses, you can hold that energy, that heat for a long time. Two of them, though, are called your working competencies. You're okay at it. You don't love it, but you can do it pretty well. That's when you pour coffee into a Starbucks cup and put a lid on top. Two of them are called your working frustrations. That's where you pour coffee in a cup that's got a hole in the bottom and it just leaks right out. And they drain us of joy and energy. And when you realize what your working geniuses, competencies, and frustrations are, it gives you a complete window into why you succeed and why you fail, and why some projects are great and why others don't work, and how you work with one another on a team. And so what we realized is that most people don't know what their geniuses are. And as a result, we don't know how to tap into one another's best selves. So 1 million people have done this. It's growing faster than anything we've ever done. And it is so fun to watch people and see how in their marriages they apply it, how it works with their kids, how CEOs realize they have to hire people to fill in their gaps because they don't have all the geniuses. So it is one of the most fun things we've ever worked on. I never knew at this point in my career I'd be doing something so darn fun. So that's the six types of working genius. And there's a book, but there's an assessment that people can take, and it takes 10 minutes and you get an immediate report back, and people are blown away by the results. And it's, so you can go to workinggenius.com and take this 10-minute assessment, and it's a life changer. It really is.
Well, that is one I've not dug into yet, and I cannot wait to dig into it, Pat. You've totally convinced me. Let me ask you this question. I'm going to do a little lightning round with you. Do you have a morning routine?
Yeah. First thing I do when I get up, I go to this app called Amen, and I listen to the Bible readings for the day. So it gives me like a Old Testament or a New Testament reading, a Psalm, and then the Gospel. I do that every day, either while I'm in the shower or before I get in the shower. So I try to start my day in the Word of God. So that's my morning routine.
Love it. Love it. What do you do for fun besides helping organizations become more healthy? What do you do for fun, Pat?
Well, this is my new thing because, you know, and Lisa, having kids for the last, you know, 26 years means I have not done a lot of fun things other than stuff I do with them, which is fun, but I don't have a lot of hobbies. And I know there's a lot of men my age that also don't have a lot of hobbies. And so I'm in the process. My wife and I are figuring out we're empty nesters in about 6 weeks. And so we're trying to figure out what that might look like. I'm not exactly sure what that's going to be, but I'm looking for it. I think I want to learn to fish because that sounds fun to me. I like to play golf a little bit, but I'm not very good at leisure activities. So I'm trying to figure out what that might be.
I know it's hard. We're alike in that too. I mean, we always say it's our business, it's church, and it's our family.
That's exactly.
We don't do a lot of things outside of that. However, let me tell you one little thing. Allie started dancing. Allie, our little girl with Down syndrome, she's our youngest. She started doing ballroom dancing, Pat, in 2018. She competed in 2019 for Dancing with the St. Louis Stars and won.
Wow.
And so has continued to do ballroom dancing. She's competing in competitions now. And about 6 months ago, because I would typically take my laptop in and I'm working, right? Which she's taking her lesson. I'm watching her and I'm like catching up. And about 6 months ago, I said, you know what? I'm not getting any younger. I'm going to take two. So I'm still got to convince Greg to do the ballroom dancing. But it's been a lot of fun. I was really surprised. It's physically challenging, but it is more mentally challenging just to think about the different, steps and stuff. So that's kind of fun. I bet your wife might really enjoy that too. Well, I know that you're really big on giving back. Pat, you believe that we are here for a purpose. And if we are not giving back, then we are not serving part of that purpose. It's really, we're here to serve. Why do you believe it's important?
Well, I mean, it sounds trite. It's the least trite thing in the world, but it's just like, 'cause God told us to, you know what I mean? He said, love me with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so I cannot imagine not doing that. It seems like that would be just completely refuting what he's asked us to do. Since I believe in him, I want to do whatever he wants me to do. So it's really that simple. Now, the good news is he gives us a sign why that's so good, because when we do that, we realize that's why we're alive. I mean, it's in those moments where like, why does this feel good? When I do things for myself, I never quite feel fulfilled. But when I do things for others, and I think that's just God's way of showing us in nature that that's where we're going to find fulfillment.
So true. Well, I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but do you have a next book in the works?
Yeah, you know, I'm working on a book, and we stalled it because we've been so busy. And we're moving our company. I'm moving to Tennessee, leaving California after 58 years of living here. And so we're in the process of moving, but I'm writing a book about wounds and how they affect leaders, and how childhood wounds and wounds in general impact leaders in ways that they often don't understand. So that's something I'm doing.
That's going to be good. And I bet that will be a bestseller too, because we all have some childhood wounds and we don't really realize how that's impacting how we show up in the world.
Yeah. And sometimes we think there are superpowers and we're like, but my wounds, that's why I got really good at this. It's like, yeah, but that's not going to leave you. You need to recognize that you need to heal from those wounds so that you can be the person you're meant to be.
Yeah. Well, so where in Tennessee are you moving? You got to tell me that.
It's just south of Nashville in a place called Franklin.
Oh, I love Franklin. Oh my goodness. We have some other really dear friends, Edward and Jean DeVries, that just moved to Franklin. Yes. And I've been there once. I was at a women's retreat at South Hall. And I'm like, what an amazing little town. Oh, that's going to be so awesome. We've got lots more to talk about, Pat, around that subject. Well, this is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra every leader needs?
Others, you know, you need I couldn't be a leader without my wife. I don't know how, you know, I mean, cause at the end of the day, we have consultants and we have colleagues and everything else, but I need that extra perspective on somebody who's just interested in me for me and telling me the hard truths and giving me support I need. So I can't imagine that. I can't imagine doing it on my own. So,
amen to that. Well, Pat, thank you so much for making the time. This is going to be the most fun that I have probably all month.
Well, it's my first. It's my first thing coming back from having the flu for 9 days, and what a wonderful way to get back to work. So, I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it was amazing. Thank you so much.
God bless you, dear.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.